And right now, time to welcome technology correspondent today. It's Steve McCabe. Good morning to you, Steve. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Very good, thanks. You are a science teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Great to have you join us today.
Thank you.
Actually, let's just sort of veer off straight away, as I'm inclined to do.
Why not?
Technology in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I was reading about a school in Auckland recently that's letting its kids have their cell phones and tweet and Twitter and everything else. We know there's some really interesting initiatives underway in some Auckland schools using modern technology. How much is it making its way into most classrooms?
Well, first of all, obviously, every single student in most classrooms has a cell phone on them. And it's reached the point now where the United Nations have recently said that internet access is, in fact, a human right. And so, obviously, if we try and take the kids' cell phones away, we're denying their human rights, apparently, which I think is a little bit excessive. But, yeah, this is how kids communicate these days. It's what they do. There was a comment made recently that employers shouldn't stop their employees from using Facebook at the office because it's like oxygen to them. Again, a little bit of an overstatement, I think, but certainly the point's well taken. That's how people communicate these days. And if that's what they're doing, then we need to exploit that rather than limiting it. But at the same time, the downside to that can be that it can be a distraction. There's no way of knowing for certain if they're tweeting, Facebooking about the lesson or about what they're doing this evening. So it is tricky.
It's an Auckland school that was using, I think, cell phones to... Oh, God, here I'm going to show my granny techo status straight off the bat. You could send your homework in. I don't know what app makes that possible, but you could use the technology basically to send homework or to send written material into the class is the one I was thinking of in particular.
Yes, there are certain systems. Moodle, for example, is an online resource which schools could employ that can allow students to email in assignments, view lesson plans, do class discussions, that kind of thing. But call me old-fashioned, but I'm of the impression that if the kids are in the classroom, you're better off actually having a face-to-face discussion with them.
Well, you've got the chance.
Well, yes. You only get them for an hour. You might as well do it face-to-face while you can.
Let's look at some of the new developments that are coming out, and Apple in particular in the spotlight at the moment. What are some of the announcements that are coming out of its developers' conference that's going to be one excited?
Well, the big deal from the developers' conference this week, first of all, was the very fact that Steve Jobs was present. We've got a man here who's that very rare thing, a CEO of a tech company who's also effectively a rock star. The man gets a standing ovation when he marches out on stage. Partly that's due to his products, partly that's due to the fact that he's still alive. We have to remember that I think it was in 2004 he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. 2009, he was given a liver transplant, and yet he's still fronting up at these things. He was looking a little bit pale and gaunt, and his voice was sounding a little bit fragile, but he's still enthusiastic, and he's still unveiling some fairly interesting products.
He's also, of course, very much the name still associated with Apple, and part of that discussion involving him keeping up a very high profile is, in some ways, that there's a great benefit for the company that he does. Is he the classic case of where the company and the product have become so associated with one individual?
Very tightly, very much so. It's pretty obvious over the last few years he's been grooming a couple of other fellows, Scott Forstall and Phil Schiller in particular, who are senior VPs at Apple, are obviously being groomed, because sooner or later he's going to have to step down, whether from choice or from necessity. But yeah, sooner or later someone's going to have to take over, and they are trying to, I think, get away a little bit from what's basically a cult of personality.
Some of the announcements that are coming out that have also, obviously a big reaction to his being there, but some excitement around some of the products as well. What is the iCloud and why is it really got everyone talking?
The iCloud is one of the things that Apple unusually actually announced that they were going to announce ahead of time. There's a lot of speculation about this. And iCloud is Apple's latest attempt to have an online service. They've attempted this in the past with things as iTools, .Mac, and most recently Mobile Me, which Steve Jobs actually basically disowned in public at this conference. What iCloud is going to be is an attempt to allow users to share content seamlessly between their Apple computers and their Apple iDevices, their iPads, their iPods, their iPhones. The idea is that when you generate content, when you make data on one of those devices, supposedly it magically and seamlessly syncs across to all the others through the cloud. Another aspect of this is going to be music. If you have music bought from the iTunes store, the idea is you don't need to keep it on one device and then copy it over using a cable. Everything's on the cloud, and so it just simply is available to all your devices.
So those days of having to burn off a CD you've got onto this or upload something that you're buying out of iTunes and then putting it on this device and then that device would be over if this theoretically were to work. There was just one storage system.
That is exactly the idea. In fact, the way that allegedly is supposed to work, and it's not actually available to check yet, they're going to be rolling this out in the next month or so, but from what I can understand, if I own a CD and I've ripped that CD onto my computer, iTunes will then look through my music collection, tell iCloud what's in it, and then make available those selections from the cloud.
Let's get the cloud straight. There's already been some controversy around it because of this idea that so much information is now being stored offshore in some kind of a cloud, some kind of a bank somewhere that's not on your hard drive or on a disk or somewhere else.
Yes.
What exists? What is the cloud as it exists now?
Well, in terms of a physical entity, what Apple have just done recently in North Carolina in the United States, they've built an enormous data farm, for want of a better word. It's basically an enormous warehouse in a field somewhere containing bank upon bank upon bank of huge hard disks. And these are all networked together in ways that are invisible and ultimately, I suppose, irrelevant to the end user. All you know is that is basically manifested in the shape of the cloud. When you take advantage of the cloud, that's where your data is getting physically stored.
You're basically going to a library storage system, or you're contracting out your information to someone else to physically store, but it is a physical entity, physically store that material. With what they're talking about, all these different kinds of technology would be able to access that library, right?
That's correct, yes. So they're trying to make this access as seamless and as transparent as possible.
How can that happen? If you've got an iPhone now, an iPod here, you can, you know, your desk computer there, how could they be linked up?
Well, let's face it, these days, pretty much every computer that we have these days is going to be on the internet. Cell phones, iPhones in particular, have internet connections, either over a wireless network or over actually the cell phone connection. So what's going to happen is your data is going to travel over those paths in the same way that, as we mentioned before, kids are accessing the internet in the classroom over their cell phones. It's the same transmission mechanism. It's just another aspect of the internet.
So the link between each and every appliance and that central storage base is going to be the internet. So the doorway, therefore, to making the iCloud work is what? What's the gatekeeper that's preventing it being able to happen now?
Well, it's basically just been a question of having the same software set up on every single device in such a way that they can all talk in the same way to access the same data. That in theory, this could have happened a few years ago. The first thing was having a big enough server farm, such as the one they've built in the United States, that can actually handle the sheer volume of data that's required. We could be talking many, many millions of people's worth of data, so it's going to take just physical size to accommodate it. The other issue, and this is actually going to be a major problem for Kiwi users of the system, is actually having, let's say, thick enough pipes on the internet to handle the amount of data flowing back and forth.
Oh, we know our pipes.
Exactly.
We've been over those. That's if you're thinking of it as a highway, this is the great big whacking great highway between us and the US under the ocean, and that's the starting point for the dissemination of all our internet data.
Exactly.
And also talk of putting a second one through, I think, isn't there? Some companies investigating that at the moment. So we could be disadvantaged straight off the bat by the same old things we're always arguing about, which is our infrastructural capacity.
Indeed. In fact, I hate to have to tell you, it gets worse. One of the other products that Apple unveiled this week was the latest version of the desktop operating system, Mac OS X. Traditionally, the way that one gets hold of this is one goes to the Apple store, buys a box with a CD or a DVD in it, one comes home and gets busy installing. And that's been the way it's been since they've been doing this. This time round, starting now, things are going to be different. It's going to be available online only. It's a download only.
Yikes. So if you've got slow internet,
you might not be getting OS X Lion.
What's this going to mean for our current high-speed broadband project? Are we forever running to catch up with what the demand's going to be?
Yes, increasingly, as technology, supply, storage moves to the cloud, and that's clearly what Apple are trying to push for very hard, as things move into the cloud, document storage and now software supply are increasingly moving into a virtual supply system rather than a physical supply system. We are increasingly dependent on, in reality, a rather skinny pipe between us and California.
Oh, I've got a headache. This is why they still need to use pen and paper, kids, in the classroom. Why do they have some kind of monopoly on the storage system, or do they? Are we going to have competing clouds? Are we going to have dirty great big sort of compounds in America and one in Germany and one somewhere else?
Of course, well, we already do. Google, for example, have been doing a variation on this theme for some time. Now, the way Google have done it is they've required that if you want to have your music stored in their cloud, I believe they call it a music locker, their idea is that you have to get the music from your computer into your space on their cloud yourself. You have to upload it. Now, that's been moderately successful. What Apple have done is they've got licensing deals with four of the major record labels, so that then they've managed to eliminate that step. They're kind of taking it on trust that you actually own the music that's on your hard disk in the first place. But what Apple have done simply is that they've managed to make it a little bit more seamless. But this already exists. You'll still be able to buy your music separately. You won't need to store it on the cloud. But unfortunately, we are moving little by little away from traditional bricks and mortar shops with things that you can actually buy and carry home in your hands.
And that in some ways actually includes the internet. The idea of the little brick and mortar shop on the internet could get caught up in this as well.
Oh yes, absolutely. Things are getting centralised. I mean, Apple were very proud to announce the other day that their App Store, which is the mechanism by which they sell software over the internet, is in fact now the leading sales source for Apple software anywhere in the world.
What's all this going to mean, not only for the whether or not New Zealand's going to be able to have the capacity to speedily do a lot of this stuff with our long distance, tyranny of distance and our pipe problems, but what's it going to mean for our gadgets? Is this where we inevitably finally get rid of having this gadget and that gadget and the next, because there's just no point anymore?
Well, increasingly, that's kind of where we're headed, really. I'm still terribly old-fashioned. I still have my desktop computer on my desk at home. But also being the cutting-edge kind of guy I am, I also have a laptop.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh that loud. Yeah, but that's in some ways it's not just a practical thing. It's almost like organising your little workspace, isn't it?
And exactly. And what I'm finding is increasingly I'm relying on my laptop. My desktop will go several days at a time without even being switched on.
We just get smaller and smaller and smaller. I could never imagine sitting typing things on a little iPhone. Typing is a grand sweeping motion. It's like playing a piano. But increasingly, we just find ourselves getting smaller and smaller and smaller and working with tinier gadgets, and happily so, it seems.
And it is a problem. For some people, they're absolutely great. For people with great big pork sausage fingers. But it's not practical.
Oh, and how's the typing teacher at your high school? ASDF semi-LKJ. It's all out the window, isn't it?
Absolutely. Kids, oddly enough, now that they're relying more and more and more on things with keyboards, they're actually getting taught less and less how to type. The irony is that the more they're reliant on keyboards, the less keyboarding skills are getting taught.
But the keyboards are getting littler as well and requiring thumb action instead of all the fingers.
Well, there is this. I've seen kids thumbing away at their phones. They're touch typing on their phones. They're not even looking anymore. It's quite a fantastic sight to see.
Where does this leave us then? Just that this is clearly the way that everything is heading when it comes to storage, and that the real problem for us is going to be our capacity again to keep up with quite rapid changes in the way things are being held and delivered to us via the internet.
Yes, it is. This is definitely, as far as we can see for the time being, the way of the future. And it's being driven by an American company who's working on American assumptions. Now, before I came to New Zealand, I spent quite a while in the United States and got very accustomed to unlimited everything. No one ever thought about data caps. When I had my broadband connection at home, it was unlimited. I had my iPhone with an unlimited data allowance on that. And that's just the way everything worked. Everything was unlimited. And I think that's what most of these new systems and gadgets are based around. The companies who are developing them are assuming that their customer base will have unlimited access. And what's going to happen is, unless New Zealand and also Australia is in a similar boat, unless we get much fatter pipes going to East Asia as well as to the west coast of the United States, and unless we start to remove data cap limits from customers, we are going to get left behind.
All right. Interesting stuff. Google and Facebook, the latest, there's been someone actually admitting to a screw-up. Who is Eric Schmidt? Well, he's the CEO of Google. And why is he, what has he screwed up?
Well, let's face it. There's a reason why the film was called The Social Network and not just A Social Network. There effectively is only one. And that, of course, is Facebook. And Facebook, as has been fairly well documented by now, was just started up by, depending on who you ask, two, three, or possibly even just one fella in a dorm room in a university in America. And it's taken over the world. Everybody's doing Facebook now. And Google, who traditionally have assumed that any market they even look at, they will automatically own, got left behind. They've not managed to pull off their own social network. They've tried. Off the top of my head, I actually don't even remember what it's called. That's an idea of how much impact it's made. Even Apple, who are usually quite good at making this kind of thing work, tried to do something called Ping, which is supposed to be a music social network. I just ask listeners, how many people are actually on Ping? And if you can name more than one, I'll be impressed. Basically, Facebook have completely owned this particular market space. And so Eric Schmidt, as you say, he's the CEO of Google. He's publicly admitted that they really screwed up, in his words. They actually allowed Facebook to totally own a market space that they think they should have taken themselves.
Isn't this a classic case of first mover advantage, which is interesting because it wasn't quite the first in many ways, but when it came to this concept or this particular version of social networking, first mover advantage, name recognition, everyone went there and stayed there, and absolutely impossible to undermine it or break in.
I think that's a very good analysis of it. Yeah, absolutely. If you and I decided we're going to set up our own rival to Facebook right now, we're going to have people saying, well, why would we bother with yours? We've already got Facebook. Everybody in the world's on Facebook. And so, yes, absolutely. Trying to take attention away from that's virtually impossible. Unless we could come up with something absolutely compelling which is sufficiently differentiated from Facebook, then we'd be wasting our time. And I think at the moment, Facebook is sufficiently well entrenched that those days are a long way off yet.
Google, Microsoft, and the web is our final subject for the day. It sounds like quite a large subject. What is it that you are highlighting?
Well, when I'm not teaching science, I do a bit of web design. And one of the great burdens that I've always had to deal with is Internet Explorer, which for many people is the Internet. On PCs running Windows for years, there's been the big blue button at the bottom left that's labelled the Internet, and it launches Internet Explorer. One of the problems with Internet Explorer, especially version 6, i.e. 6, is it doesn't really conform to published standards for web page behavior. It doesn't really conform to the way that web pages are meant to work. As a result, it's a bear to design for. It's always been a bit of a problem. Now, where Microsoft come into all this is they're starting to take the wrappers off their next version of Windows, and they're saying that the next version of Internet Explorer that's going to go with it is actually going to conform to standards. And the fact that a company like Microsoft actually has to release a press release saying, guess what, we're now standards compliant, is pretty shocking in itself. The way that Google tie into this is they offer, and again, we're going back to the cloud computing concept here, they offer Google Docs, which is an online alternative to programs like Microsoft Word, for example. Now, what they're saying is you access those programs through a web browser, like, for example, Internet Explorer. What they're saying now is they're no longer going to make any effort to make sure that their applications work well in old versions of web browsers such as Internet Explorer. So what we're possibly seeing, and again, for web designers like myself, this is a cause for the most wonderful celebration, Internet Explorer might finally start to go away.
Why has it been so loathed?
Well, as I say, the big problem is web designers, when they're trying to put together web pages, they will make a page that conforms to all the published standards of HTML and CSS. It works just fine. You preview it in Internet Explorer, and everything's in the wrong place, and your buttons don't work. Because Microsoft have not designed it in such a way that it actually addresses the standards that other browsers do.
I've heard geeks moaning about this more than just about anything else, and I've never really fully understood it. So thank you for the explanation. And you think it may now finally be on its way out?
Thinking and also praying.
Which is very unscientific of you.
Yes, but when it comes to Microsoft and Internet Explorer, science kind of goes out the window.
You just grasp it. Whatever greater power will relieve you from this crisis. It's been lovely talking to you. Thanks for your time, Steve McCabe.
Thanks very much.
Our technology commentator today. He is a science teacher.